Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And right off the bat, what I figured out, and it kind of ended up shaping the whole book, was, wow, when it comes to meat, Americans have an extraordinary sense of entitlement.
Maureen Ogle researched the history of meat production in the U.S. for her book, In Meat We Trust. Little did she know it would put her in the middle of the food debate. She gives us some historical perspective on why we consider meat a necessity in this country. American universities are joining the fight against worldwide hunger and poverty, a story from Harvest Public Media. Philip Ackerman Leist describes the difference between organically and conventionally cultivated soil. Then our recipe from Daniel Orr that pairs kohlrabi with some tropical flavors. Let's get our weekly dose of food news from Luann Johnson.
Foster Farms has issued a recall on chicken in the wake of a major multi-state salmonella outbreak. The CDC connected the outbreak to Foster Farms after a child fell ill with salmonella Heidelberg in May. On the evening of July 3rd, the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Services issued a recall of Foster products possibly contaminated with salmonella. A day later, the CDC updated the number of affected people to 621 across 29 states in Puerto Rico. Representatives Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut and Louise Slaughter of New York have criticized the USDA's slow response and are calling upon Congress to close Foster Farms facilities. FSIS defended its decision to not issue a recall earlier, stating this was the first definitive link to Foster Farms and Salmonella Heidelberg. We have a link to the complete list of recalled products on our website, eartheats.org. There are mounting complaints about food served in some Midwest prisons. Aramar Correctional Services serves over 600 correctional institutions across North America, including prisons in Ohio, Michigan, and Kentucky. On July 30th, inmates at the Ohio Reformatory for Women at Marysville, Ohio, found a maggot in a turkey roll being sliced for dinner. A similar incident happened at the Trumbull Correctional Institution in Leavittsburg, Ohio. This came on the heels of at least 30 prisoners reporting food poisoning symptoms in Jackson, Michigan. Back in March, two employee unions and a Republican senator from Michigan urged the state to reject a $145 million prison food contract with Aramark after citing food safety concerns, security issues, and undertrained staff. Kentucky has held a contract with Aramark since 2005, and the state saved taxpayers about $51 million over that 10-year contract. Recently, some lawmakers in Kentucky began questioning Aramark's practices. Kentucky's contract will expire at the end of this year, and Aramark representative Karen Cutler has said they will bid again. And according to a new study, 175 chemicals with known hazardous properties are legally used in the production of food packaging in the U.S. Think foils, cans, pans, and storage containers. As reported by Food Safety News, those products continuously release mixtures of synthetic substances into food at low levels. Many of the substances are classified as carcinogenic. Others are considered endocrine disruptors. A statement from one of the study's authors, quote, "From a consumer perspective, it is certainly undesirable and also unexpected to find chemicals of concern being intentionally used in food contact materials," unquote. We've got more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org.
And you can be the first of your friends to hear about stories like these. We're posting updates 24/7 on Twitter at EarthEats. Luann Johnson, thanks.
You got it.
Many of the tools and techniques that have made Midwestern farmers global leaders have emerged from the research at the region's land-grant universities. Now, a federal international aid program is exporting that knowledge to help alleviate hunger and poverty. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, the longstanding task remains daunting.
At the start of President Obama's first term, the world was facing record-high food prices. They further devastated countries already struggling with hunger. In response, the administration created Feed the Future, a multifaceted effort housed at the U.S. Agency for International Development. At Iowa State University, Kurt Rosentrater's work on biosystems has made him an expert on fish feed.
this diet here, everything is the same except we are using soybean oil instead of fish oil.
He went to Bangladesh for Feed the Future to help identify areas in that country's aquaculture system that could be improved. In Bangladesh, Rosentrader visited farmers and feed mills large and small. He saw some fixes, such as dust handling and quality control, that seemed obvious, but they turned out not to be so straightforward.
It takes time and money to do those things, even though they're simple things. So low-hanging fruits aren't always so easy to pick, unfortunately.
This realization, of course, is not new, nor is the United States' effort to help alleviate hunger and poverty. In its 5-year report, released this spring, Feed the Future says the program has improved nutrition for 12.5 million children and brought new technologies or management practices to 7 million farmers. This is not direct food aid. And USAID's Jada Doyen McKenna says that's why the ag schools and folks like Rosentrader are so important.
Partnerships with institutions like Iowa State and Kansas State and Michigan State, institutions that are great land-grant institutions that have deep history and expertise and research in agricultural problems and innovations, are natural partners for our work.
But they don't guarantee success. Brandeis University PhD candidate Danielle Fuller Wimbush is writing her dissertation on the Feed the Future program in Haiti. She says Feed the Future's focus on supporting local farmers and increasing yields does distinguish it. But she says its execution hasn't always lived up to its potential.
There has been a lot of criticism. There's a lot about the program that could certainly be improved.
Engaging local communities more from the start, ensuring women and men benefit equally, and creating truly sustainable projects, all of these, she says, are supposed to be part of the initiatives, but often are not. And she says those are familiar lessons the government could have taken from its history of international aid work.
To be honest, I was surprised at how much has not been learned.
An Iowa State project in Africa, though, seems poised for some success.
Let's walk over to the other side of the lab bench. I think that'd be a good starting point.
This is Suleiman's lab in the Animal Science Department. Machines here can warm or cool samples or run experiments on up to 96 tiny vials of genetic material at once. These are among the tools she'll use to analyze samples from chickens in Ghana and Tanzania.
We are going to address one of the biggest disease problems for producing poultry in the continent of Africa, and that's Newcastle disease virus. If we can help to improve the natural resistance of birds to this, it will mean a tremendous amount, especially to the smallholder farmers.
At universities in Ghana and Tanzania, chicken housing and lab facilities are nearing completion so that ongoing genetic testing can be done in-country after the U.S. role is finished. Lamont says working on Feed the Future is different from doing research with a grant from, say, the Agriculture Department.
The USAID, because it has the development aspect of it, really looks for projects that come closer to immediate application of the results.
So one question that lingers is, can ag researchers make this $3.5 billion federal effort the one that finally achieves lasting impacts on the recipient countries? The United States has a long history of hunger and poverty relief programs abroad, yet the need remains. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up, a story from Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon, just in time for county fair season. We learn about mutton busting. Historian Maureen Ogle published her third book, Ambitious Brew, The Story of American Beer, in 2006. She was putting the finishing touches on that and then doing the usual rounds of promotion when Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma was released. She was completely unaware of the food debate Pollan's book had sparked when she selected the topic for her next book, The American Meat Industry. Now, in 2014, the conversation about meat production has completely changed, but she still stands by her historical description of how we got here.
The conclusion I came to after 7 years of working on this book was that the system that we have now, this much maligned so-called industrial ag, industrial meat production, industrial livestock production, is the result not of a big corporate conspiracy, but of shifts decade by decade, century by century, of trying to adjust to a population demographic that has changed drastically in the last 400 years.
A demographic that is largely urban and doesn't grow its own food. Not everyone liked that conclusion. Ogle says she's had several conversations where people have accused her of working for Monsanto or being paid to write the book by Big Ag. She says that's absolutely not true. More about the controversy in a bit. Ogle started her research way back with the first settlers, and she realized that the system we have now is a result of a couple things. As Americans, we expect there to be lots of meat, and we expect to pay very little for it.
Right off the bat, what I figured out, and it kind of ended up shaping the whole book, was, wow, when it comes to meat, Americans have an extraordinary sense of entitlement. And that dates all the way back to the colonial period when settlers came over here and suddenly discovered that, A, land was apparently infinite, and, B, there was nobody to stop them from having livestock the way there would have been in the old world. And within 20 or 30 years, the colonists had already developed a reputation as the people who eat meat, and we have never let go of that.
She says in many senses, the story of agriculture in this country is actually the story of urban growth. Well, what about the small farm, slow food movement? She doesn't hold out much hope for that overtaking the Big Ag way of doing things. And she cites history, the idol of the small family farm hasn't existed in this country for a long while.
And the reason it hasn't been true for about two centuries, at least in this country, is because farmers operate to earn a profit and to meet the needs of a market that's driven by people who don't produce food, namely people who live in cities. There's just not any practical way we can go back to a system that existed 200 years ago unless we take our entire society back 200 years. And I don't know about anybody else, but I'd really prefer not to do that.
Perhaps the most eye-opening part of our conversation is that Ogle says we consider meat a necessity, just like water and electricity. That's why when meat prices go up, we are very, very unhappy. Think about it like this, she says. The way to keep a consumer-driven economy healthy is by lowering costs of necessities. So from that perspective, the industrial way of raising meat is actually remarkably efficient.
Does it mean it's the only system we'll ever have? Probably not. Personally, I'm quite excited to see what the next 20 or 25 years bring in agriculture. But I think many critics of the system are going the wrong direction because they keep looking backward for solutions. I'm very much despite being a historian, I'm a very much forward-looking person. And I think the idea that somehow we're going to go back to some imagined rural idyll of small family farms, an idyll which I might add never even existed, it's very unrealistic. It's not really getting us anywhere. It's not going to solve the problem of how do you feed the 90% of people who live in cities.
You can see why certain foodies would have an issue with that argument. The takeaway for her after 7 years of living with this topic in the book, not everyone wants to know the full story.
It's been a lesson for me to really understand at a gut level how important it is for me to keep my mind open. To me, reality is very nuanced. There really is no black-white in the world I live in. Everything is a complicated gray, and I just remember that every day.
Okay, so some foodies have vowed to not read her book, but that's not the group she's hoping to reach. She wants the folks who are baffled to read her book, and then make up their own minds. Maureen Ogle is an historian and the author of In Meat We Trust. Connect with her at MaureenOgle.com. Coming up, our vegetarian recipe for the day.
All my herbs, I always rough chop. I think that if you chop them too finely, then what happens is the flavors get muted and it gets lost. Whereas if you get a nice big chunk of cilantro, you know you're eating cilantro.
Pro tips from Chef Daniel Orr. He's making a salad featuring a local veggie, but with a tropical twist. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick, Cadillac Boulevard, and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga, more at touchstonewellness.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Kohlrabi, to me, is one of the things that most intimidates young cooks in the kitchen.
It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
When you can get them like this, so fresh and so young, they're super delicious to eat raw. Today, I'm going to make a kind of a cool little salad out of it with papaya and curry vinaigrette.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Chef Daniel Orr in the kitchen once again. He took your requests for which ingredients you need to become better acquainted with. Kohlrabi was right up there. You can follow along on this recipe and see photos at eartheats.org.
We're going to cut off the base, which tends to be the toughest part. Then what you do is you can kind of peel it by just going around the base and grabbing the exterior skin from the bottom and pulling it up. And that will, any kind of tough celery-like strings will come off with that exterior skin, and you'll be left with a really tender interior. All right, now we're going to cut this into bâtonnets, and bâtonnets is just a little bigger than a matchstick, so it's a little thicker than a matchstick. All right. Okay, I'm going to put some diced red onion. Now we're going to add our tropical flavors, which is a papaya. It has a really nice sweet flavor. It's not as sweet as a mango. All right, we're going to dice this up. Okay, we're going to toss that with our kohlrabi and red onion. You see how those colors are starting to pop a little bit? Okay, we're going to add some chopped cilantro. All my herbs I always rough chop. I think that if you chop them too finely, then what happens is the flavors get muted and it gets lost, whereas if you get a nice big chunk of cilantro, you know you're eating cilantro. And then one of my go-to sauces is my curry vinaigrette. It's one of those that I keep in the squeeze bottle, and I use it to decorate plates or use it in salads. I also use it on coleslaw. We're going to add a quarter cup of the curry vinaigrette. Toss that around. And you can see everything's turning nice and yellow. And we'll put it on a plate. Okay, and that is our kohlrabi and papaya salad, Anguilla style.
Chef Orr gave a shout-out to Anguilla because he spent several years cooking there early in his chef life. You'll notice, actually, that a lot of his recipes have a bit of a Caribbean flair to them. We're lucky enough to have a bunch of them posted at eartheats.org, ready and waiting for you to try. For his book Rebuilding the Food Shed, Philip Ackerman Leist had to first define what the term food shed even means. He says it was coined way back in 1929 by Walter Hedden, who was chief of the Bureau of Commerce of the New York Port Authority at the time. Hedden was thinking about it in terms of the economics of food moving in and out of a certain region.
And then, you know, that term was brought to the fore again in about 1991 by a scholar named Goetz, and he started to actually begin to consider it as the flows of the food in and out of a particular area. And so it's a term we've been playing with since then, and I think it's actually really useful to us.
Ackerman Leist is our featured author in today's program. He's also a farmer. Here's 1 minute with him where he talks about the difference between organically cultivated soil and conventional soil.
You know, the fact is, you see the difference when you pick up the soils. You can feel the difference. You actually see the difference in production, and it doesn't matter whether there's drought or the weather's too wet. You know, the organically managed soils do better, and that's, you know, really most of that is attributed to the fact that you've got much higher levels of organic matter, you know, there in the organic soil. You know, so these are the things that we see in a forest soil, for example. We see the humus, and we see actually, you know, a lot of different kinds of soil structure, and that's because there's you know, so much biodiversity there within the organic soil. That's not the case within the conventional soils. And, you know, with the food waste now in the United States being at about 40%, you know, that's absolutely absurd. And the fact that when we do capture it, only 3% of what we do capture actually goes back, you know, into organics. You know, we've really got to be thinking much more seriously about maintaining fertility within the full cycle.
Well, thanks. Have a good one.
Okay, you too, Annie. Thanks
Alrighty.
For your time.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Philip Ackerman Leist is an associate professor of environmental studies at Green Mountain College and the director of the Farm and Food Project. Learn more about his book, Rebuilding the Food Shed, on our website, eartheats.org. A furry beast, a brave rider, and a roaring crowd is all you need for the rodeo tradition known as mutton busting. Think of it as bull riding, but for six-year-olds, and the furry beast is actually a woolly sheep. Mutton busting was first introduced back in the 1980s, but the crowd pleaser is now a favorite at many rodeos and county fairs across the Midwest. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon followed one mutton buster as she got ready for her very first ride at a rodeo in Colorado.
Six-year-old Nevaeh Salgado stands quietly off to the side while her father, Dominic, signs a waiver. She's one of the many kindergartners clinging to their parents' legs. Most are dressed in cowboy hats, denim, and Western-style shirts. Nevaeh's wearing a pink plaid shirt, bedazzled with a sparkly galloping horse.
What are you coming to do?
I'm gonna ride the sheep.
Nevaeh saw other kids try mutton busting at last year's rodeo and insisted she try it this time. Participants are usually between the ages of 5 and 7, so at 6, Nevaeh is right in the sweet spot. Her mom, Daisha, says she can be a little spitfire.
She's very independent. She is. I mean, she's always, Mom, I can do it myself, and I can do this. And I mean, when it comes to animals, she loves animals, so this is something that's a good experience for her.
Last night, we practiced before I went to bed. I fell off, and then I got back on, and I hanged on tight around his neck.
A chain link fence with thin plastic slats separate the sheep from the group of young mutton busters while they wait. Nevaeh presses her face against it to sneak a peek.
Can you tell which one you want?
The one that's standing up.
That's a big one.
Yeah, that's why I want a big one.
It looks pretty fluffy.
It does.
Just like the sheep, rodeo staff corral the kids into a small holding pen.
All right, there we go.
And fasten on black vests and helmets.
Does that fit okay? Feel okay for you?
Feels kind of hard, but feels good.
Yeah.
The mutton busters get a few final stretches in.
All right, let's touch our toes. Touch your toes.
Some last-minute pep talks.
And whatever happens, you do the best you can.
And it's off to the arena.
Listen to these people. You're crazy.
easy. Balance out some little kids riding some sheep.
The children stand in a line, waiting their turn to be lifted up by a couple cowboys and onto the back of a sheep. They stand wide-eyed, glancing up to their parents in the stands, looking nervous and excited. Everyone's ready with technique advice for the kids.
Are you ready?
75 for Lily.
Know what to do? Okay, just grab on as hard as you can. Come off, you want to have fluff in your hands, okay?
Here comes Novaya.
Novaya clings to the sheep, arms around its neck, and when the cowboys let go, it darts forward in a straight line. Six seconds later, and Novaya slides off and gets a face full of dirt.
Holy mackerel!
The kids are judged on how long they held on, and for style. Nevaeh's 88 points was a high score, enough to put her in second place. And after all the adrenaline in the arena, Nevaeh is reunited with her parents.
Angel, oh my goodness, I'm so proud of you. Good job. Were you scared?
No.
Was it fun?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I ate, there was dirt in my mouth.
Was there dirt in your mouth?
A mouthful of dirt, a couple fistfuls of wool, and a shiny belt buckle are her prizes. And because she's only six, Nevaeh says she'll be back next year for another try at first place. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
They put out great stuff at Harvest Public Media. Read and listen to their stories about food, fuel, and field at harvestpublicmedia.org. And as always, our website is the place to go to follow recipes, to read interviews with authors and farmers, and to keep up with the latest in food news. Connect with us at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Philip Ackerman Leist, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Maureen Ogle, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for being part of the Earth Eats community. Till next week, I'm Annie Corrigan.